Hi, everyone. This is Drew. Hey, we've been providing authentic, in-depth interviews about spiritual stuff for over 15 years now. But there's a change a-coming. Now, if you've already heard this message, just skip ahead to the interview. But if it's the first time, will you do me a solid and hang with me for just a few minutes? You know, about 15 years ago when I moved back to Canada after being a pastor in Australia, I realized that there was no way in the world that I should be in any form of spiritual leadership for so many reasons. But I think the main reason was because I've always struggled with belief. Now look, I'm still incredibly curious about what gets people through the night, and more often than not, it ends up being someone's faith or spiritual beliefs. So I created a radio show that set out to interview cultural icons and religious leaders, celebrities, and, you know, everyday people about what they believe, but more importantly, why they believe. And along the way, my faith has gone from simply being a noun to a verb. And I've also discovered that doubt is actually more compatible with faith than certainty. In other words, I no longer feel guilty about my doubts. So thanks for tuning in as I interview all sorts of people about all sorts of faith. I hope their journeys, no matter what they believe, have had a profound impact on your journey and that your faith has also become a verb. Because in my opinion, being spiritually neutral, that's an oxymoron. By the way, thanks to Joy Radio for letting me broadcast all of this spiritual tension, because I think this tension is where real faith is cultivated, in between hope and doubt. Together, Joy Radio and my team have created Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. Okay, that's all the kumbaya stuff. Now here's the ask. And I know, I'm the same. I'm rolling my eyes as well. It's kind of like when Wikipedia puts up that note asking for money every once in a while, or when your local publicly supported radio or TV station does one of those annoying fundraising campaigns. I completely ignore them as well. I guess my thinking is that an organization like Wikipedia probably makes enough money anyway. Or, worst case scenario, they'll find enough people to support them. But please, if you're a regular listener of the Drew Marshall Show, man, I kind of really need your help. The station I've been broadcasting on for over 15 years has never actually paid me to do the show. Instead, they've let me try to sell advertising. But that's been a little more of a challenge than I imagined, because religious advertisers sometimes feel that my show isn't religious enough, and quote-unquote normal advertisers sometimes feel like we're too religious. So it's been a long, crazy uphill battle over the last 15 years just trying to make a living in that tension. Trust me, I'm struggling to pay the bills just like you are. But as we start season 16 in September, we just found out something huge. Joy Radio will now be charging me for airtime. Now, surprisingly, this is standard practice for a lot of radio shows, especially on faith-based radio stations. But the bottom line is that there will now be an astounding 30% hike in costs for me. Ugh. Airtime's not cheap, and to be honest, finding even more advertisers to cover that 30%, it's kind of freaking me out a little bit. So maybe you've been downloading our podcast and don't actually have to listen to the advertising that our radio audience listens to during each live four-hour show. And by the way, just so you know, any advertising we've actually been able to find has only ever covered about 70% of our annual costs. So the ask is this: would you consider going from being just a consumer of our show to becoming a patron? Would you mind throwing us a few bucks each month just to help us cover that 30% difference? Heck, you know what? If we can get enough patrons supporting the Drew Marshall Show, we could feasibly get to the point where we become completely listener-supported without the need of any advertising. Now that would be amazing. So, a patron. What? What is that? Well, a patron was the kind of person who allowed Shakespeare to create a product that also spoke of similar life tensions. Tensions that most people were living, but few were admitting to each other. A patron is someone who appreciates the product they're consuming so much that they're willing to throw a few bucks towards securing a future for that product. Now, just FYI, there are over 100,000 creators being supported by patrons through Patreon right now. So this is becoming the new way to say thank you to those who create the products we all consume online. Now, I fully understand the fact that I'm certainly no Shakespeare. I get that. But someone said to me recently that they would absolutely support our show monthly. Methinks there might be others. Yea, but maybe not. Let's findeth outeth. Yeah, I should never do that again. So here's the ask. Will you support the Drew Marshall Show $4 or $9 or $19 a month? By the way, that's American coin. So sorry to everyone listening from parts of the world whose currency is kind of struggling against the US dollar. But here's the other thing. If you cannot afford it, please, obviously, no worries. When I used to be a pastor, I would say, hey, when the offering plate goes around, if you can give, give. If you need some, take some. So just take our show for free, guilt-free, if you can't afford $4 a month. Please. Because the conversations we're having in the Drew Marshall Show, I honestly feel need to be heard no matter what. Look, my dream is to have the most brutally authentic spiritual talk show in the world. And here's why that's important to me. Because I really believe that a key ingredient to spiritual growth is authenticity. And the tension of a brutally authentic spiritual talk show makes some people feel uncomfortable. But as far as I'm concerned, faith is messy and it can be brutal. But instead of looking the other way, our show dares to stare back into this beautiful mess called faith. So thanks for your support as we continue to live in the tension between belief and doubt, and while trying not to take ourselves too seriously along the way. Hopefully you'll laugh, sometimes you'll cringe, but no matter what, please know that what I care about most is brutally authentic spirituality. Now, go drink the Kool-Aid, will ya?
Cult reference.
And become a patron of The Drew Marshall Show. Thanks for listening. Little prayer for Drew. It's Tim's birthday today, or yesterday, or tomorrow. When is it again?
Tomorrow.
What dress are you going to wear? Party dress.
Ooh.
Are you having a party tomorrow?
Don't know. Probably not.
Did you already have one?
No. We'll have one eventually. My wife's really
we'll
busy.
We'll have one eventually?
Yeah. Like I told you, I'm a summer baby, so birthday parties.
So nobody cares.
Well, it just people weren't always around. My wife's in the middle of teaching a course right now, so she's a little distracted. So when all that stuff's out of the way, we'll do something.
Yeah, I know why your wife's distracted. I've seen you. I'm not going to finish that.
I have no idea where to go with that.
We used to be cabin mates at Teen Ranch at camp together.
Yes,
pal. Little buddies.
Distracted in a bad way, maybe.
Listen, you're listening to The Drew Marshall Show. It's a bit of a special day today. Tim's 50th birthday is tomorrow.
Yes.
So we're playing songs from the year he was born. Oh, yeah, that's enough of that. Listen, we have got a great guest on the show, except it's going to be hard because we're idiots, and this guy is a sharp...
Is he smart?
He's got a Papa Has Dough.
Oh.
Dr. Edward Fazer, Papa Has Dough, PhD. He's the author of Five Proofs of the Existence of God. His website is Edward, F-E-S-E-R, but it's said Fazer. No jokes, no Star Wars jokes, Star Trek jokes, whatever
no,
it is.
No, nothing.
He joins us from... Are you on the West Coast, Dr. Fazer? Where are
you?
Are you in California? Can you hear me now?
He does.
Oh, there we go.
Sorry?
Are you in California?
Yeah, I'm in California, Los Angeles.
What part of the TMZ are you in, the 30-mile zone?
I'm in the San Fernando Valley.
Oh, beautiful.
I'm a valley guy.
Yes, you are. Like Tully.
Yeah, oh my gosh. I got myself this
balloon. Which is a kind of a phenomenon because the kind of stuff you write is so not Valley Girl.
I guess I'm a weird mashup of medieval Talmudism and 21st century San Fernando Valley culture.
Oh, man. Well, Five Proofs of the Existence of God. These days, there's so many books that cross my desk that I'm just sort of numb, unless it's got a good little hook to it.
Or a picture on the front.
Or a scratch and sniff on it or something like that. But this book provides a detailed, updated exposition and defense of five of the historically most important, but in recent years largely neglected, philosophical proofs of God's existence. Well, it was... good of you to join our show. Thank you, Dr. Fazer. We'll talk to you another time.
Very good for you to have me. I appreciate it.
I don't know how to do this interview. Like, I've interviewed lots of people. Lots of people, but I don't know how to do this one because what he talks about is the stuff I've been looking for. So I don't know if you know anything. You probably don't know anything about my personal journey, but I've been involved in the evangelical scene. I was involved in the evangelical scene for 30 years. I used to be a pastor, and then... Was it now 7 years ago? 7-8 years ago,
yeah.
I came out as a doubter. I came out of the tribe of certainty and started to admit publicly my thinking that I'm not convinced that there's a God. Now, people have taken that, Dr. Fazer, and they've said, "Oh, you're an atheist." Well, that's not what I said. I just said I'm not convinced that there's a God. I'm not certain that there's a God anymore. So I call myself a red-letter agnostic theist. Do you understand that term at all?
I suppose so. I suppose you're certainly, obviously, not an anti-theist, to coin a phrase that's often used these days.
Very hip these days.
I think you're someone who's sympathetic to theism, but you're not convinced that it's true. You're open to its being true, but you're not convinced that it is. Is that the idea?
No, I'm just not certain.
I'm just not certain.
In other words, instead of using the word faith, I substitute that word with hope.
Yeah.
The word believe. Instead of using the word believe, are you a believer? I'm a hoper. I hope there is a creator, a good creator. Because imagine if there's a bad creator, that would suck.
Very much so.
Yeah. So you're the perfect guy to have on my show. But dude, you got to dumb this stuff down for me, man.
Well, I'll do my best. And for what it's worth, I might add that I was myself much stronger than the agnosticism that you described yourself as having. I was an atheist for about 10 years during the 1990s. And I came back around to theism by way of philosophy, by way of the philosophical arguments for God's existence of the kind that I spell out and defend in the book. So I know where you're coming from. I mean, I certainly went through that phase myself. And I ended up in an even more distant place from theism than you are. But I came back around, and it's important to emphasize, and this is a big theme of the book, that I did so through rational philosophical arguments, not through an appeal to scripture or to an appeal to faith, or certainly not emotion or anything like that.
No, you wouldn't have any emotion in that. That's craziness, emotion. You know what I would like, and I actually would like you to chastise me over this one, okay? Because trust me, I've been chastised many times over this. After 30 years of being certain there's a God and sitting in the evangelical church and hearing people up in the pulpit, up in the stage, talking about how God showed up this way and God showed up that way and God touched them this way and God touched them that way and whatever. I look back over the 30 years and go, man, I can't remember one tangible encounter with this God that apparently is loaded with tangible encounters for everybody. So,
yeah.
So I felt, I threw it out there. I said, hey, God, I know that it's not supposed to be all about, ooh, can you do a magic show for me? You're supposed to have faith, which requires maybe no magic. But could you do something? Just something tangible. And I don't want people say, but you're blessed, Drew. You're blessed. You've got so much. No, I don't want God's toys. I don't want his stuff. What I'd like is for my father, my heavenly father, to put his hand on my shoulder figuratively somehow, or even physically. But I know I could excuse that. Oh, I had too much coffee that day, and I felt like someone's hand was on. But some way, God, you know what I'm looking for, and could you do it in such a way that I wouldn't spend the rest of my life excusing it and just rationalizing it? Is that a dopey thing to want?
I don't think it's a dopey thing to want, but of course, and I think this is part of the reason for your agnosticism, as you describe it. Of course, someone could always say, well, if you do have some sort of profound experience like that, some sort of profound religious experience, perhaps it could be written off due to psychological factors or wishful thinking or what have you. So the question that naturally arises is, well, how do you know whether it really is just that or whether it's genuine?
Exactly.
And part of the answer to that question, I would argue, requires getting into deeper background philosophical issues of the sort that I get into in the book. So as I emphasize in the book, in the history of Western philosophy going back 2,500 years, the mainstream view, this may seem unusual today because people think of university professors and philosophers in particular as being highly skeptical about these things these days, and these days they tend to be. But historically, the dominant view was that you could demonstrate rationally the existence of an uncaused cause of the world, and not just one who knocked down the first domino 13 billion years ago at the Big Bang, but one who keeps the world and everything in it, including you and I, in existence from moment to moment to moment. And this was an idea you find in Aristotle, you find it in Plotinus, who was a follower of Plato, you find it in Leibniz, an early modern philosopher, you find it in Thomas Aquinas, in Maimonides. and many other ancient, medieval, and modern philosophers. This was the mainstream view. And it was not an appeal to religious experience. It was not an appeal to feeling. It appealed to rational philosophical argumentation. And if those sorts of arguments work, which I argue that they do in the book, then that gives you a larger context within which to interpret religious experiences of the sort that you're talking about. I wouldn't deny the value of those sorts of experiences for some people, but I would say they're less fundamental to the question of whether religion is rationally justifiable than these deeper philosophical arguments, and these arguments that go back, as I say, as much as 2,500 years in the history of Western philosophy.
Tim, what did you get out of that? Because you're smarter than I am.
Well, I think that it sounds interesting. I think in many ways, as you were introducing yourself and your journey from atheism into theism, it sounded a lot like C.S. Lewis, who was very much a philosophical, intellectual individual who didn't necessarily believe or have any thought of God, and then eventually stumbled into it through, I guess, an intellectual process.
But there's along the way, though, Dr. Fazer, you would have, well, I've experienced this, and I'm sure you've experienced this, which is you're overthinking this. Stop thinking so much. Just have faith. And that statement makes me, like, have a mini vomit in the back of my throat a little bit.
Yeah. Well, me too. I have exactly the same reaction to it. And it was part of the reason why I ended up being an atheist for 10 years, because, of course, there's a very common understanding of religion. I would say it's a caricature, that it's fundamentally about faith understood as some kind of emotional, evidence-free commitment. And that's just not the case. Of course, there is a kind of religion that's like that. But that's not the only approach one could take toward religion. And it's not the dominant approach historically within Christianity or within other religions. It's not that there's no place for emotion in religion. There's no place for some kind of personal relationship with God. But the idea is rather that the mainstream tradition historically in Christianity and in Western philosophy was that fundamentally there are rational grounds that one can give for religious belief. It doesn't boil down to some will to believe or anything like that. And so, like you, this idea, you know, that, well, it's all about faith in the sense of just some irrational commitment, some emotion-based commitment, that's something I find very off-putting myself. But it's important to emphasize that the idea that that's what religion is about is, historically speaking, an aberrant view. It's a really very modern, you might almost say, sort of 20th, 21st century therapeutic idea of religion. That's not the idea of religion that you see in major Christian thinkers like St. Augustine or Thomas Aquinas, or that you see in ancient philosophers like Aristotle and Plato.
Okay, so here's a... Let's see, I don't even know what the question is amongst all of these statements, but I'd like to throw this out in some kind of schmozzled way. Schmozzled? Is that even a real word?
Laverne and Shirley.
It's totally from Laverne and Shirley. without faith, it's impossible to please God. So you got to have faith. Then there's the other one, which is, but if you've got God figured out, you've got the wrong God. Because God, if God is God, then there's an unfigure-outability. Huh? That's another good word. So if you can,
but of course, that raises the question of what we mean by faith. So, you mentioned this scriptural passage: without faith, it's not possible to please God. I don't deny that, but again, that raises the question: what do we mean by faith? Now, I would say that the mainstream understanding historically, and the one you see in writers like Thomas Aquinas in the Christian tradition, is that faith is essentially a matter of believing something because it's been revealed by God. Because, you know, God can't make a mistake. God is infallible. God is all-knowing and so forth. So if God really reveals something, then it's got to be true. And so you need to have faith in the sense of trusting it or believing it. But, of course, that raises the question, how do you know it has been revealed in the first place and isn't just some illusion? Well, that's where reason comes in. That's what you have to give. That's where you have to give philosophical arguments that God actually exists, that he's actually given a divine revelation. It's only once you've done that that faith in the sense of trusting what God has revealed can step in. Otherwise, faith just ends up being some entirely irrational commitment that anybody in any religion could appeal to, in which case, you've got no reason to believe any of the religions. So the traditional idea is the idea that faith itself presupposes rational argument. It presupposes philosophical evidence and argumentation for the existence of God and for the claim that a revelation to actually occur. They're not actually in conflict. One of the main themes of my book is to emphasize this, that it's not, you know, to be religious, to believe in God, does not require you to abandon rationality. On the contrary, the essential truths of religion, such as the existence of God, the nature of God, can be known through rational argument. And only once that is all in place does faith, in the sense of trusting what God has said, come into play.
Dr. Fazer, when was the last time you were stumped by an atheist?
It'd be quite a long time. And I have to say that one of the things that brought me back to theism, away from the atheism to which I'd been committed for about a decade, was revisiting a lot of the atheist arguments. What I was doing was I was still a grad student at the time, but I was teaching introduction to philosophy classes, and I was also teaching a philosophy religion class. And so I was teaching a lot of these traditional arguments from Thomas Aquinas, from Leibniz and Aristotle and people like that. And I was doing the usual atheist thing, this Richard Dawkins-style approach of lining the arguments up and then shooting them down with stock objections. Has a cause, what caused God, that kind of stuff.
You should have done it like Christopher Hitchens with a drink in your hand. Would have gone off way better.
Well, I did, but I can't mention that on radio.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I was doing that, and it got boring. So I thought, well, I'd like to, because I didn't think the arguments were any good, and I thought they were silly and so forth. But I thought, well, if you're going to make this an interesting class, it would be worthwhile trying to get students to see why anybody would have taken these arguments seriously. So even though I was an atheist at the time, I started to try to think about them the way someone would look at them who believed in them, right? And so I got back into the philosophical literature, the writings of these different thinkers, and wanted to see how they would respond to a lot of the stock objections, so I could prepare my lectures and make the subject a bit more interesting for students, at least for a couple classes. And as I did so, I started to see that a lot of the stock objections that atheists raise against these arguments are just aimed at straw men, aimed at caricatures, aimed at things that Aquinas and Aristotle and Leibniz never said in the first place. And so I gradually went from thinking, well, these arguments are lame, to thinking, well, actually, there are a few things you could say in defense of them, to gradually thinking, well, you know, these are really interesting arguments. And after a few years, I decided, you know what, these arguments were correct all along, and I've been wrong, and I've been badly misunderstanding them in my years as an atheist. And I would say that most atheists, certainly new atheist writers like Hitchens and Dawkins and people like that, but even a lot of professional philosophers who are atheists, if they don't happen to specialize in the subject, if they don't happen to specialize in the subject of arguments for God's existence, the objections they raise tend to be very superficial and based on a very shallow understanding of the arguments.
That's such an interesting journey. I mean, you really, you know, I actually give you, I would give anybody more credit, or I would listen harder to somebody who has sort of lived the other side. They've lived both sides of the coin.
Well, it's right? Like AA. You know, you only trust the people who have gone through it themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Tim, you actually wanted to ask something
earlier.
Yeah,
I did.
Wait, now remember who's on the line.
Okay.
Right, this guy's got his PhD.
So I need to dumb it down for him?
Yes, please.
Well, as we were talking about the whole idea of faith, you know, based on, you know, being certain of what you hope for and, you know, certain of you do not see, that kind of thing.
Oh, now faith, hold on. Faith is the confidence that we have hope for. Oh, no, hold on, let me get this right. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see.
Yeah. Now, and the professor, Professor Fazer here has gone on to say that, you know, there is definitely an intellectual aspect to that. And somehow I feel like there's this whole mutual exclusivity going on, you know. And I think, you know, we're talking about the Enneagram later and how there are very different types of personalities.
I was just going to say this kind of thing. Well done, Tim.
You know,
keep going.
It's kind of like, why would God be one-dimensional?
Yeah.
You know, he
only makes sense to the smart people.
Yeah, or the people who are not smart and yeah. Have to feel the hand of God.
Yeah.
I think.
What are you saying?
Well, you know, on Drew's shoulder, the idea that, you know, God can speak to us in the areas that we truly understand and see things
based on our wiring.
More clearly. Yeah, I think that God's more than welcome to do that, and I think He does.
What kind of an atheist were you, Dr. Fazer? Were you like? Well, were you Hitchensy? Is that even a thing?
Yeah, which philosophy of atheism did you follow?
Yeah, because let's not pretend the camp of atheism is undivided.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I would say that for, you know, Lisa, again, this was about 10 years of my life, and I would say at least part of that period, maybe earlier, my attitude was maybe a bit more of the Hitchens-Dawkins style obnoxious atheism. And I think a lot of people who when they're young and they study philosophy and they first encounter some of these arguments against God's existence or objections to arguments for God's existence, and they're very impressed by them, at least initially, that can lead to kind of an evangelical fervor of its own. You know, you want to kind of convince other people to give up religion and so forth.
Right. But so you hang out a little bit with Ray Comfort and Kirk Cameron then.
And try to deconvert them or something, right? Yeah. As time goes on, that loses its appeal. You grow up a bit, and you have a more balanced view. And I think for a lot of my years as an atheist, like, you know, I like to think my attitude is a little bit more reasonable and balanced and open to the give and take of rational discussion than you see in new atheists, who tend to be very dogmatic and obnoxious. So at least for, you know, a period of my atheist years, I guess, I was sort of in the... Of course, the new atheism wasn't a thing then. This was back in the 90s. But, you know, my attitude was somewhat like that. But then it evolved and it matured into a bit more reasonable sort of atheism. And then eventually I moved out of atheism altogether, as I said.
But did you grew up Catholic, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I was raised Catholic. And then in high school, I gradually started to move away from the church. And then again, in my college years, eventually I just abandoned religion altogether and became atheist.
Right, so you went Catholic, atheism, you went Catholicism, atheism, Catholicism.
And then back, yeah.
Yeah.
And back again.
Did you ever consider
the son type stuff?
Like yeah. Did you ever consider the other side of the ship? Eh? The Protestants or what about the Happy Clappies? Why not join them? Oh, no, you're a philosopher. I don't think there's any philosophers that hang out with the Happy Clappies, do you?
No.
I would say I was certainly open to, at the time, to some of the traditional Protestant arguments against Catholicism, which I later came to reject those arguments and come back to Catholicism. Yeah. But no, I was never attracted to the happy clappy sort of. I've always had a kind of aversion to that, so it's just not my thing.
Yeah, I've said many times, I think denominations are based more on personalities than doctrine. Just my take on things. Okay, well, let's finish with this. By the way, you got to get this book, kids. I don't know why I keep saying kids. Five Proofs of the Existence of God. And the website you want to check out is Edward Feser. That's F-E-S-E-R. EdwardFeser.com. Or just type in Five Proofs of the Existence of God, and you'll find the book and get it on Amazon and everywhere else people get books. Did you just hold that up to the Facebook crowd again?
I flashed a bunch of pages so they could get a taste.
Were there any pop-ups?
No.
What kind of, Dr. Feser, what kind of God do you actually believe in now?
What kind of God do I actually believe in? Well, I would say that at least the core of the traditional idea of God is one that is shared, it's common to, I don't want to say all the details are common, they're not, but the core at least is common both to Christianity and its different varieties, Catholic, Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, also to Judaism and Islam, and also to ancient Greek thinkers like Aristotle and Plotinus. And that's the idea of God as an uncaused cause of the world who keeps the world in existence from moment to moment to moment, who's infinite in power, infinite in knowledge, outside of time and space, infinitely good, and so forth. That whole ball of wax, that traditional body of divine attributes or divine characteristics, that's something I would say can be known through reason, through philosophical arguments, and it's something that can be agreed to, and traditionally was agreed to, by thinkers from all of those different backgrounds, ancient pagan Greek thinkers, Jews, Christians, Muslims alike. Now, of course, since I'm a Catholic and a Christian, on top of that, I also think God is a Trinity, that there is in God a distinction between Father, Son, Holy Spirit. That's an additional claim, though, of course, over and above the philosophical claims. And for that, you need to appeal to divine revelation. But at least that more generic conception of God, which is common to the different religions, that I claim can be known through philosophical arguments like the kind that I set out in the book.
Have you actually... I said that was the last question, but I keep coming up with more questions. Have you ever had a tangible encounter with the Creator or with evil? Have you had a supernatural, tangible encounter, period? Or are you too, what is it, right brain? Or
one of them.
Are you too cognitive to have any spiritual encounters? You know what I mean?
Well, I suppose it depends on what you mean. I mean, you know, if you're asking me if I've had some sort of supernatural experience of a miracle or something, the answer would be no. If you're asking me, you know, do I have a general sense of divine providence, divine guidance, and so forth in the course of my life? I think anybody who's religious has that, and I would certainly claim to have that. But of course, I understand it's something that an atheist would simply write off as some kind of self-delusion. Yeah. And I wouldn't appeal to it as somehow the foundation or rational basis of my belief in God. For that, I'd appeal to the philosophical arguments.
Dr. Edward Faeser, he is the author of Five Proofs of the Existence of God. And we have a copy of that book here in the studio to give away. So if you have any interest, Tim is holding the book up. Can you get a little closer to the camera, please, there?
Yeah.
Thanks. On our Facebook Live, what is it, stream? I don't know what the heck the kids call it these days. Dr. Faeser, thank you for your time. I know that this book came out last year, and so you're probably tired of doing interviews about this book. You're probably on to your next, you know, four or five books by now. But you've actually written something that I could read that talks about stuff that I'm interested in. So thank you for doing such a thing.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Dr. Faeser on the Drew Marshall Show. I like that guy. We've had some good guests today.
Yeah.
Boy, I'm supposed to like slow it down in July.
Well,
but
it started out with me, so, you know,
we
set the bar pretty low. So everything else seems pretty awesome.
Slowed it right down there.
Yeah.